And that's the thing that APRA's got to realise. They've got to allow these lending back into the market. Otherwise, if people can't get this 60% lend on their assets, they've got to sell. And again, that's akin to wanting an apple, but APRA tell you to cut the tree down. What do you do next year?
In this episode, we'll continue the conversation with Kevin Young, founder of Property Club, housing over 5,000 millionaires. We'll also hear about how to apply his property investing strategy for success and how his book, Broke at 20, Retired at 27, will change the way people think about property.
Welcome to Property Invest Story, the podcast that goes behind the scenes of property investing stories. Here's your host, Tyrone Shum.
Young says that initially, poverty was what held him back from investing in property, saving the money over a period of time in order to place his first deposit.
Without any money, you can't get started. But having been there in the club, I've got solutions for people. So at our second barbecue in Sydney back in 1994, there was a policeman and his brother was a bus driver. And they wanted to get started and they realised, you know, they were paying a lot of tax. And I said, what sort of equity have you got? And they said, we haven't got any shares, we haven't got any money, we've got kids we're bringing up and we've got secondhand cars. Luckily, their mother was there. And I said, well, do you own your own home? And I said, you can go guarantor for the boys to get them started. And she said, no, I rent too. She said, but Dad died at Dubbo and he's got an old shack out there that I've got. And we're estranged, so I never ever got a chance to see the shack, but I guess it's worth something.
Mm.
We had it valued, and it valued at $70,000. She nearly fell over. But she was able to guarantor for boys, and they were able to buy two properties each. So they went from having nothing and no way to move to being well off and not paying tax, and their mother was able to see them without costing her a penny, see them up and on their feet and progressing well. So that wasn't an opportunity for me because obviously mum and dad didn't have anything. I bought them their first home when I was 21. So I had no one to borrow from. I had to save the money. So I think that's a bit of the lesson for people who think property's too dear today. It's not. You just got to work hard for it. And you always did in the past as well. It was the first property I bought for mum and dad was $7,200. And I can't remember how much money I was earning, but I had to save up 10% deposit in those days, which was 720. And I think that would have taken me all of 12 months to save that, if not more. Well, I can tell you that was in a Brisbane suburb. And today, that same suburb to buy a property, a new property, and it was fairly new, you'd be probably looking at about $460,000.
There you go.
So
wow.
That same property, it was on a large block. And so they knocked the house down and they built two houses on it. So it would have got more than the 460, but if it stayed as the property 460, I can give you some ideas. I've got in front of me 1980, Sydney was 71,000. 10 years later, it was 173,000. 10 years later, it was 309 in 2000. So this is why I love property. It's if you buy good quality stuff, and ignore regional cities, regional towns, mining towns, they're just too risky. Go new and go close to the city centres. It's a good, safe investment.
Young has also experienced setbacks throughout his property investment journey, which he says have shaped him into a more persistent person and therefore have contributed to his success.
I had a long conversation, about a two-hour conversation with a journalist. I was driving from across Tasmania to Launceston, and he asked me all sorts of questions about my background, and I had a long conversation with him about the club, and it had only been going about 5 years. And the next thing I know, I was back in the Gold Coast, and I had a phone call from him, and he said, call off your dogs. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, I've been flooded by emails about the article. I said, when did you print it? He said, this morning. And I was in bed. And he said, the first one came at midnight from London, would you believe? So I quickly got dressed, went down and bought the paper, and I was on page 2 and 3, the whole thing. this guy had thought I was a shyster because just at that time, the Bulletin journalist had won an award for uncovering a Dudley Quinn Levin and the two-tier marketing operation that he was running on the Gold Coast. So this bloke thought he'd found another Dudley Quinn Levin. And so he sort of said, is he Dudley Quinn Levin? And pictures of my office and saying, is this where people get trapped? It was terrible. And, of course, I told him that I'd been made bankrupt back in the mid-'80s over some people that I was suing for $7,000. So it was like a throwaway line, and it was a joke at the time. I was a multimillionaire, and the judge had decided when I sued them that everyone should return to their former positions, which was not an economic thing. You couldn't do that. But anyway, I won't go bore your listeners with all that. But anyway, he blew that up in the article. Now, this is an article in 2000, and it was headlined, Former Bankrupt, is he running a two-tier marketing scheme? And all my friends knew about the bankruptcy because it was a joke. But anyway, he did that. I mentioned that I'd been divorced. So he had mentioned that I'd been divorced. I had custody from two young boys, which was most unusual in those times. Didn't mention that. Didn't mention any of the positives or anything that I told him about the success of the club. And at that stage, I think we'd created 800 people that had become millionaires. We were quite surprised at, and see, they'd picked up two booms in that period. We were quite happy with that fact. That was just completely missed. So that was a big setback. I was happy that the members rallied around, and he never persisted with any follow-up stories. And
that would have been quite a PR issue then for you overall. How did you handle something like that? Because you would have got quite a lot.
Well, Kathy and I were shocked. I hadn't been in the media prior to that. And the cloak and dagger that goes with it, I had a knock at the door, and a guy said, who does your PR? And I said, we don't have any PR. And he said, well, I run a PR company. How about I look after you? And if this sort of thing happens, I can jump on it and fix it for you.
Mm.
So I said, okay.
Yeah.
He said, first of all, I need to know what skeletons are in your closet. And Kathy and I looked at each other and said, well, there's no skeletons. You know, we're here to help people. And everything we tell them and do is free. Anyhow, subsequently, I found out that this PR guy went to school with this same journalist that had done the dump on us. And he was just down there to really see if they could get some cement around this mud that they were throwing at me. And, of course, there was nothing for it, so it never persisted. So that was an ill wind, and it was picked up about 4 years later by a journalist trying to come up with something sensational in a different state, in a different magazine. And he just virtually regurgitated all this stuff again. And, of course, with this mud throwing, they never persist because they quickly find out from my members that everything they've said there is a lie.
That's right.
And that's what the media, but it's that does. One throw that does the damage.
Yeah, the media does that, unfortunately. And I don't tend to agree with a lot of things that they say, particularly if you're looking at properties, as we've discussed about earlier in our previous episode as well, that the media can distort what the real thing is, and they just want to put a story to sell advertising.
Well, you're right, Tyrone. And one of the journalists said to me, we hide behind Murdoch's millions. And this is the problem. I was wrongly quoted on the 7:30 report with a mistake that a totally unrelated business did, and they were sued for it. And I don't even know where their office is, but they confused the issue and got me in it. And I didn't do it at all. The 7:30 report are refusing to apologise. They've still got it on if you Google me. We've gone to the government agency that controls it, and they've said sue them. We've gone to the commissioner for the ABC, who didn't even bother responding to us. Now, in England, when the same thing happened, and that was that report that I was referring to, I was trying to start the club in England, they came out with all of page two, regurgitating this garbage again. And over there, it was quickly fixed up with a process that they should introduce in Australia. I took a small claims court out for £5,000. Initially, I'd complained to the paper. They went back disdainfully and said, well, sue us, knowing that it would cost me $1 million. I wouldn't be able to do it. And the retraction probably in 5 years' time on page 73. But the small claims court meant that this journalist, without representation, had to front me and a magistrate, 30 days later to justify his story and why it wasn't libelous and misleading. And, of course, he had no justification at all. So the paper came back and said, look, would you be happy to withdraw on the basis that we sacked the journalist? So I said, okay.
Of course.
Now, wouldn't it be good if we had that in Australia? Yeah. And we couldn't have this willful stuff that goes on with journalists. And I don't buy papers anymore in magazines because I just can't trust what's in there.
Yeah, that's right. Sometimes I think that, you know, people utilize the media so that they can get their branding out there, because when they say that they've been featured on so-and-so or this magazine or this newspaper, mm-hmm. it sounds good, it builds credibility. But at the same time, I also err on the side that sometimes they don't tell the truth in the story, because if it's a boring story, they're not going to share it with people. They want some kind of drama. Well, thank you for sharing that, Kevin. I really appreciate that. It's an interesting story to hear about your setbacks and how you overcame that as well. And
I guess it sort of reinforces the persistent bit of a successful person, because I could have just run away and hide. I could have just come back to Australia. And I just thought, no, bugger, it's wrong. A lot of people are going to think it's the wrong thing to do. And I was ready to launch the club over there with the Martin Roberts, who was the biggest TV personality. He loved what I was doing and was happy to get up on stage and endorse the club.
Yep.
And because this thing on page two had threatened his position with the BBC, he had to withdraw. So there's a lot of ramifications when mud's thrown beyond what you originally think.
Rely on statistics rather than take advice from other investors. Young says that it is important to always check the validity of any potential mentor's credentials.
Luckily, I had a mate that used to bring a lot of overseas speakers, motivational speakers and wealth creation speakers, on a tour of Australia on a circuit. And I could get in to see these people, nothing, because he was a mate. But he'd say, look, don't bother coming to see him because, you know, he's it's all froth and bubble, he used to call it. There's no substance to them. And that's what we say to these people that are trying to get educated. Make the people who are giving you advice give their credentials in writing. You know, if they reckon they've got 200 properties, get a list of all the properties where they are. Mm. You know, I've got a list of where my properties are and happy that people can see them. The fact that I've been in business for 50 years, I tell them that. I think if that was compulsory by law, we'd see a lot of these so-called gurus rapidly disappear off the scene. So I've never taken advice from anyone. I think it's just I've relied on the facts and figures, and when I was learning it, when I got into real estate, I had a nickname there called the Facts Man, because I just had a thirst for knowledge, and if people want to know anything about an area, they'd come to me and say, what are the prices in this area like? And I'd tell them, or when's the new bridge going to go in, or when the new hospital's going to go in, or new shopping centre or whatever.
Yeah,
and all these things influence prices.
Talking to Kevin Young about his property investment strategy, he says that the secret is to never sell. He shares with us how his advice helped a retired couple who had also invested in property live a better life.
I've got a lot of people, over 5,000 people in the Millionaires Club now, and we went on a 5-star tour of Africa, and we started in Cape Town and went on the Blue Train, which is on the bucket list, and then we flew to Johannesburg, and then took a light plane into the middle of the savannah, and we tended in style with hot and cold showers and crystal glasses and all sorts of things. And we had a couple that were retired. He was very tall. He was about 66, 67, just roughly the same age. And we noticed that when we flew, we were business class. He went economy, which would have been very uncomfortable for him. And so on the safari, we were there when the migrating herds were on, so we saw all the different animals together. It was a fantastic trip. It really was a bucket list job. And I said, why are you going to economy everywhere? And he said, oh, well, I've spent my life saving, and it's just part of my nature. So I said, what do you reckon is the profit that you've got in your properties that you've accumulated? And I think he said something like $2.5 million or something or other. And I said, well, at some point in time, that's going to double, isn't it? And he said, well, yeah. And I said, so you're going to have something like, you know, probably $7 or $8 million at some point in the future. And he said, yeah. And I said, why don't you just borrow half of last year's capital growth, which was something like $120,000 on it, something like that anyway.
Yep.
And I said, it's a safe lend for the bank. It's only half of last year's capital growth. And we worked out that that would have kept him below a 60% loan to valuation, and that would have satisfied the banks. And then I said, you never pay that back because the repayments on, say, $100,000 might have been $5,000 a year.
Mm.
And I said, you know, take that out of borrowings the following year and the following year. And once they saw it, the light came on, they changed their travel plans. They didn't go back to Australia economy. They went business class up into Dubai and went shopping there in Dubai and then went around the world and back into Western Australia. And that's the secret of what our plan is never sell, but borrow conservatively your past annual increase for 1 year, which is very, very conservative.
Mm.
And never sell. Selling is akin to chopping down your apple tree to get an apple. What do you do next year? So simply never sell, borrow, and still retain it.
Yeah, so basically, if you've got the golden goose there, never kill the golden goose, but just keep letting it lay the eggs.
Yeah, yep. Unlike bananas, they don't go rotten.
That's right.
Coming up after the break, we'll delve further into Kevin Young's strategy.
Now, it's a good strategy. I've used it all my life. I retired at 27.
How he built a successful portfolio.
And this is the philosophy that I eventually had to come up with because I was selling my properties. And then I realised that soon I'd have to go back to work because I'd be out of property. So then the only alternative was to borrow.
He tells us about his great new book.
Incidentally, I've got a book coming out, it should be out in January, called Broke at 20, Retired at 27.
And that's next. I'm Tyrone Shum, and you're listening to Property Investory. Hey, podcast listeners. Are you enjoying listening to these stories? If you are, then subscribe to Property Investory on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Simply visit likemypodcast.com to subscribe today. Enabling him to retire at the ripe young age of 27, Young explains how his strategy works through buying and holding properties, then using the equity to live off.
Wait till your debt to equity is 50% or less, and then it's an easy lend to go up to 60% loan to value. So if you've got $4 million worth of property and $2 million worth of debt, to take it up to 60%, you can borrow $400,000, which gives you a very, very good lifestyle for a year. Probably for 4 or 5 years lifestyle, because this is tax-free money. And in that 4 or 5 years, that portfolio would have gone up possibly 30% or 40%. If it's in the boom period, it probably would go up more than that. And then you simply revisit it again and take your loan up to that 60%. Now, it's a good strategy. I've used it all my life. I retired at 27. Incidentally, I've got a book coming out. It should be out in January called Broke at 20, Retired at 27.
Oh, that would be an interesting read.
And this is the philosophy that I eventually had to come up with because I was selling my properties. And then I realised that soon I'd have to go back to work because I'd be out of property. So then the only alternative was to borrow. And luckily, I had a very good Commonwealth Bank manager at the time who held my hands with this process, and he helped me overcome a lot of the bad principles that I thought I'd picked up at school and reading in the paper and all that sort of thing. So I was able to do it. But the problem I've got right now is that I predicted the credit squeeze that Australia is in 5 years ago. And for the last 6 years, we've had a credit squeeze brought on by a banking monopoly here in Australia. I don't want to get political with you, but these backdrops are changing all the time. And if you understand them, it makes it easier to do predictions. And if you get your predictions right, that's where you can make money. And it's back to the banana story again. So what we've got overlaying a banking monopoly and this credit restriction, we've got an ill-informed APRA forcing the banks to only lend do 10% of investors. So normally investors are 35% of the market, say. They want banks to only lend 10%. And they're not telling the other 25% of investors who can't give money what to do to avoid the pension. They're just saying, oh, you're naughty boys. What these people normally do is invest in off-plan or new properties, and that's more bananas in the store. What is effectively done is stop bananas getting into the store. So developers, builders have got store projects around there because they can't get these seed investors because the banks have been told not to lend to them. And they're saying to people, I can't guarantee that your approval will last 2 years when it's finished. I might change the rules on you, and suddenly you've got to come up with $500,000 or $600,000 or $700,000, and we're not going to lend it to you. So it's led to a catastrophic drop in the production of the right sort of properties, and it's fooling the market because the commentators are looking at the total number of properties being built and saying, isn't it great? But it's the wrong sort of bananas. It's the inner city high rise. And that's been made up by only a handful of builders in each of the capital cities.
Mm.
And so the vast number of builders are really being squeezed, can't get funds, and the vast number of property investors can't get funding.
Mm.
Now, for some unknown reason, APRA forced this on. And so if you and I were a banking monopoly, we'd say, well, we can only expand our investor market by 10% instead of 35%. We will just lend to the cream. So we'll say to people, well, we want a high deposit off you and we want to see that you've got a high income. And so they're scooping the cream of the investors, and that means the rest of the people can't get into the market and can't bring more supply into the market.
Yep.
So how do you make money out of that? You look forward to less of bananas in the store, increased prices.
Yep.
So right now, people should be finding some way to get money to get into the property market, the new property market, not older properties because they're problems, knowing that this APRA is actually not containing prices, is inspiring prices. And so the Sydney boom will continue has continued all this year. It should have stopped and will continue all next year as well. To a lesser extent, Melbourne market will be continuing for another 2 years over the market can't correct. And the biggest market in Australia in the next 12 months will be the Gold Coast market. Simply, of course, the demand for bananas there is greatest in Australia. It's 3.5% population growth, which is more than double the national average.
Yeah, that is
crazy. And yet you look at the supply of bananas coming in there, and the mayor of the Gold Coast opened our conference last year. And he was saying to the audience that normally they produce 15,000 bananas, using that analogy, a year. But for the last 5 years, they've been producing less than 5,000 into that market.
Wow.
So rents are rising, prices are rising, and my properties down there went up between 17 and 20%.
Young confirms that by accessing a line of credit, you can borrow from the accumulated wealth that your properties have accumulated. This can sustain a savvy investor's lifestyle for many years.
Yeah, we say get a line of credit, and then you only pay interest on the bit that you're drawing down. So this month you might want to go business class around the world, so you draw out $30,000 or whatever is needed.
Yep.
And when you come back, your need for that month might only be $5,000, so you just draw $5,000. The month after that, the kids might want to go to university, so you got to find out what that's going to cost and draw that money out and shoot them off to university. So wants and needs never stop. They're insatiable. But the beauty thing about property and that line of credit is that you can now satisfy your bucket list because you've got the wherewithal. And in my book, I've got the property prices going right back to just after the Second World War. So the people can, it's like playing a game of Monopoly. In fact, I've got a computer program I did up, and we call it Financial Independence Date. People actually plug and play historical data into that to see that the plan works and what sort of properties to buy safely. And again, that's a free service that we give people.
Excellent.
But I'll give you an example. We'll imagine it's 1980 and you're in Sydney. The average price was $71,000. 10 years later, it was $173,000. And you've still got a $71,000 debt. You've got $100,000 there of equity. And you know the banks will lend you 60%. So that's $102,000. So you can borrow another $31,000, which is about half of the original cost of the property in 1980.
Mm.
And so I haven't got in my book of what the wages were around at the time to see how well you could live on that sort of money. But from the bank's point of view, it was a very safe lend because they went had a debt of $102,000 on that property. But 10 years later, it was worth $309,000. So their security was always nice and safe. And someone else has the property. Someone else has the capital growth, not you.
Young elaborates further on his strategy, stating that there are 13 critical factors to look for in an investment property in order to ensure its success. These factors have been recorded in a checklist on Young's website, which enable you to compare properties when looking to invest.
There's a bit of finessing in there, and we've got a lot of tips on our website. But one I just started putting out there, when we choose a property, you can have two brand new properties side by side. One we'll endorse and the other we won't. And there's 13 different critical factors that we look at in a successful investment property. And we're happily giving that out free on our website. So we've got a checklist of 13 that we'll give out to anyone so they can get that list and go around, and it'll help them compare different properties to get the right sort of property.
Oh,
and the end result of all that, if you do it right, is that the extra tax that you're not seeing to Canberra and the tenant's money pay all your outgoings.
Mm.
And that's why our people find it so easy to get 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 properties, because they're not putting their hand in their pocket.
Having stated a preference for buying newer properties, Young explains that part of this strategy is also tax related.
13 tick lists to make sure we get properties that have got a lot of tax credits in them.
Oh, okay.
So the builder has paid for the carpet, but it comes off your tax. The builder has paid for the kitchen, but it comes off your tax, etc. So you can't depreciate land, but you can the building and the content. So no two houses are the same. And so 90% of new houses or units or townhouses will reject because they don't tick enough of those 13 items. But when they do, you find the tax that you were paying and now you're not goes in your take-home pay. You add that to the tenant's money and you're paying no money at all. So when you're driving around, you see a nice property and you know it's going to cost you nothing, you pop it into your portfolio. And we've got a software program that I devised that makes it very easy because you work out what your income is going to be next year. It works out how much tax you're going to be paying. And then it works out the number of properties you need to bring your tax back to zero. So I've used that program and I haven't paid tax since I was 27. And I've been investigated every 3 years by the tax department.
Legally.
Because they don't pay tax.
Legally.
Legally. Mm, yeah, yeah. Now, most people don't do that because it'll cost you a fortune to get these depreciation reports on a number of properties before you made the right decision. And that's where that 13 checklist comes in handy. It directs you towards, if you're going to get the Qantas report, just get off one or two properties rather than 20 properties that you may be looking at. So it eliminates a lot of the costs. And also, we where we can, we'll get the builder to pay for that depreciation report. And it depends where the market is. But right now, the market's good for buyers and we can screw some really good deals off them. And that's one of them that we say, you pay for the depreciation report.
Mm.
Another one we're doing is before we settle, we overcome a lot of problems that couldn't arise later because we know once a tenant's in there, they form a lot of things. The builder never comes back. Next thing you've got an unhappy tenant, stops paying the rent. Next thing you're bankrupt. So what we do in our contracts, we have a clause that we don't settle until a professional has gone through and checked for these things that a tenant might be unhappy with. And that costs us about $350. And we get the vendor to pay that as well. But it means he doesn't get his money until that
is complete.
Has complete and ticked off.
Buying new properties also means that there should be minimal upkeep needed. Acquiring a builder's guarantee will ensure the property is maintained where necessary, which in turn provides sustainability in the future.
Another thing we're doing there, we're actually we're getting the builders to personally use as a guarantee for 10 years.
Yes.
How about that?
Yep.
So they sign a form that says, I personally warrant the next 10 years to maintain the property against any water ingress. And that's where most of the problems arise in time. You know, the bathroom leaks or the outside leaks to the inside or somewhere. Well, now they escape that because of the six-year structural, in some places only three-year structural. And they say, that's not my problem. So the body corporate or you have to pay that amount, which can be quite substantial.
It is.
But now we'll have the builder person warranting it. Now, what I like out of that is if they give that guarantee, you know they're going to build a really good product because they don't want to come back.
Young says that the fear of failure has motivated him to persist and diversify. This personal habit has greatly contributed to his successful property investment journey.
This is an unusual one, and it's always motivated me. And it's the fear of failure. And that's why I struggle when you want to know what had gone wrong. So I've had a lot of setbacks, but I've just persisted and won. So I think one of the lessons is diversify, but another one is have this fear of failure so that you persist. And I think everything that's come my way is an ill wind. I've persisted and I've won. So if the property market's down for 3 or 4 years, I haven't got demoralised and sold. I've said, well, historically it's going to come back again, and it will. And so I sort of persist. I never really got involved with older properties after my first couple when I realised you're constantly putting your hand in your pocket for surprise cash, and surprises are what sends you broke. So it's new ones, and I think the fear of failure has driven me to make sure I look at all the things that can go wrong first, do as much as I can to overcome them, and then when something comes up by surprise, I don't want to be a failure, whether it's a business or a relationship or a particular, even the property club. So I think you can learn a lot from people who are failures because you look back at their story that they're telling you and you think, you didn't persist. You know, you really just didn't persist or you didn't diversify. So they're probably the two big ones, along with research, of course, which probably goes into those two traits. You have to have research to be able to beat them.
The 13-point checklist is available for download on Young's website at propertyclub.com.au. If you have any further questions or want to find out more from Young, he tells us the best way to get in touch with him.
The other one is I've got Asked Kevin Young. It's, you know, I'm talking technical stuff that I don't know, but I get a lot of questions from people and I do about a 3 or 4 minute response. And I think we've got about 120 episodes out there now answering these questions. So I do get a lot of compliments from people that it's free, that they learn a lot from them.
Thank you to Kevin Young, our guest in this episode at Property Investory. If you want to hear more about his journey spanning over 50 years, and during that time purchasing more than 650 properties, became a millionaire under 30, started his very own property club, then visit our website at propertyinvestory.com. Simply type in the search bar Kevin Young and select that episode to learn more about his story. Also, I would love to hear from you. If you have any questions, feedback, or want to share your story, send me an email to hello@propertyinvestory.com and let's start a conversation. Thanks for listening.